Next weekend at a park in New York City, seekers and beaters and snitches will toss around quaffles and bludgers at the 4th annual Quidditch World Cup, the game inspired by Harry Potter. Now, if you recall, proper Quidditch is played on flying broomsticks.
The quaffle is released, and the game begins!
And so to make it work in our world, you'd have to either A, rewrite the laws of physics, or B, tamp down expectations, play on the ground, and call it Muggle Quidditch.
Beaters, raise your hands.
Keepers, raise your hands.
Brooms down, eyes closed. The snitch is loose. Brooms up.
This is a recent practice of the University of Maryland's Quidditch team. There are 7 players to a side. They all straddle brooms. They all wear capes. The field is elliptical. At each end of the ellipse are 3 hula hoops mounted on poles. And the rest of the rules are a bit too complicated to explain here, but basically there are a lot of people running around throwing balls in different directions.
It feels like flying except you're on the ground.
Intercollegiate Quidditch has been around for about 3 years. It started at Middlebury College in Vermont.
Harry was essentially the same age in the first book as I was when the books came out.
That's Alex Benepy. He's the commissioner of the International Quidditch Association and one of the founders of Muggle Quidditch.
I would say the majority of people in a typical liberal arts college like Harry Potter. It's like my generation's Star Wars. Everybody has seen it and loves it.
Now, as the story goes, Muggle Quidditch began one autumn afternoon in Middlebury, Vermont, when bocce got boring.
Every Sunday we would play bocce. And we would dress up in sort of faux European clothing and heckle each other in British accents. And then one weekend, Xander was like, you know what, I'm bored of bocce. Let's play a real-life version of Quidditch.
The next weekend, Alex and his friends got together to try it.
We were wearing towels as capes. We had household corncob brooms. Our goal hoops were hula hoops duct taped to chairs and then a few garbage cans. And it was amazing.
Another Middlebury student named Xander Manschell decided to write down formal rules using J.K. Rowling's imaginary game as a guide. And except for the flying, the game is pretty much the same.
Go!
I can!
Let go!
Just get him, go.
Fast forward to 2010, there are now more than 400 intercollegiate Quidditch teams around the world. Almost every Northeastern liberal arts college fields a squad. And so the inevitable is happening. Quidditch is going mainstream. The captain of Maryland's team, Valerie Fishman, is trying to get the sport recognized by the NCAA.
I think that having NCAA status will make it a little bit, give it a little bit more credibility. And it might help keep it around a little bit longer because I'm kind of hoping that it stays around after the Harry Potter generation leaves college.
But until then, the winner of this year's International Quidditch World Cup will still be able to proudly display the international trophy, which is
made of plastic, spray-painted gold. The main body is a vodka bottle with a plastic serving saver on top filled with chocolate coins and a plastic wizard. And we write the winner's name on the trophy in Sharpie.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. One place where the economy is not hitting as hard as might be expected is the grocery store. Food prices are holding steady, for the moment at least, and that's surprising because the price of grain is on the rise. We called on NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax to explain the disconnect. She joins us in our D.C. studio. Good to have you with us, Marilyn.
Hi, Lynn.
So let's begin at the source, Marilyn. Why is grain so expensive?
It's a simple matter of the short supply and this huge global demand. There's a growing number of middle-class families in India and China, and they're buying more food. But this year, the global grain supplies are running pretty short. We've had a lot of bad weather. There was the flooding in Pakistan and a drought in Russia. It was especially bad there. The drought got so bad that the government banned wheat exports, and that helped drive up wheat prices for the rest of the world. And in this country, corn is especially in short supply. U.S. farmers didn't produce enough this year. There were some weather problems, so now they can't satisfy all of the demand. They've got ethanol producers, food companies, livestock growers. So corn prices surged 17% just in October, and they've been up pretty sharply all year. So some analysts are now looking at it saying it could go even higher, and that's partly because the rising crude oil prices. When oil gets expensive, more people want to make ethanol, and when you make more ethanol, that increases demand for corn.
Well, if the price of grain and corn is so high, why isn't that translating into higher prices on our grocery store shelves?
Well, I know this is going to sound a little strange, but actually relatively little of the price of your groceries is tied to the cost of the food itself. The corn that's in that box of cereal is only worth a few pennies. So even if the price of corn goes up, 60%, that wouldn't translate into a 60% price hike at the register. That box has all sorts of costs, packaging, marketing, but the single biggest cost is transportation. You got to get the corn to the cereal maker and then get it to the grocery store. So actually, the price of gasoline matters more than the price of the corn itself. But now we're in a situation where we have rising oil prices and rising corn prices. So together, we're really getting these inflationary pressures in the pipeline. So General Mills, for example, just announced that it's going to raise the wholesale prices on some of its cereals in mid-November. The company said that those price hikes will just be in the low single digits, but still, it's a price hike.
So we can expect to see things like cereal, for example, as you were talking about, those prices might be going up.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. What about meat and dairy products? Because obviously livestock need a lot of grain. Doesn't that then contribute to the cost of food as well?
Right. It does. So far, we really haven't seen that. The Consumer Price Index for this year so far shows that food prices are up only 1.4%, and that's the lowest annual food inflation rate we've had in almost two decades. But the point you're making about the livestock is true. They eat a lot of grain, and that starts to increase the cost. That if you're raising livestock and you're paying more for your feed, you're going to want to raise your prices. So that's putting inflation into the system. So the projection right now for food inflation for next year is about 3%, which would be twice this year's annual rate. Now, compared with the inflation we had back in the 1970s, 3% doesn't sound like a lot, but people are really squeezed these days. Social Security payments haven't gone up at all this year. Most workers have gotten only really meager raises. And, of course, we have millions of out-of-work Americans who don't have any paychecks. So, even if there's only relatively small inflation coming, it would be very unwelcome at the grocery store.
So the message is, take advantage of those stable prices we're experiencing right now for as long as we can.
That's right, Lynn. Eat up.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wex. Thanks for being with us, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Lynn.
He was down, he was out, but now Conan O'Brien is back. The late-night TV star's new show starts tomorrow night on TBS. And as baseball fans saw during the playoffs, Conan took to the air in a blimp to promote his show.
Hi there, Conan O'Brien promoting my new show on TBS. So he asked those guys to get me a cigarette boat and four ladies in bikinis. What do they give me instead? An orange blimp and this guy right here. Would you get this for successfully landing in a light mist?
Actually, this one was for being with your mom.
Okay, all right.
Joining us now to give us the play-by-play on late-night TV moves is Jeff Jensen, senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. Welcome back to the show, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
So Conan returns to TV Monday night at 11, but this show will be on cable, not on one of the broadcast networks. And so is that a gamble for him?
It is something of a gamble, but also it's a great opportunity for him. I mean, there were a lot of people who felt that when he was the star of The Tonight Show, that it was a little bit more of a conservative, restricting creative environment for sort of a loose, shooting-from-the-hip, kind of edgy comedian like Conan O'Brien. Being on basic cable in an environment where there's a lot less pressure on him and a little bit more creative freedom could allow Conan to sort of be a more unleashed creative persona.
What do we know about the show so far?
We know very little, and in fact, that's one of the reasons why a lot of people want to tune in. They kind of want to know, what kind of show is Conan going to bring to air? Is it going to be more like his 12:30 late show on NBC? Is it going to be a lot like his college campus tour that he did this past summer? I think it will be. We're all very interested to know, is he going to be able, or is he going to try to do versions of his classic bits that are kind of now owned by NBC?
You know, all the drama around this new show began a long time ago when NBC agreed to give Conan O'Brien Jay Leno's Tonight Show seat. But as we all know, that didn't go over too well, did it?
No, it didn't work out well at all. they moved Jay Leno out of The Tonight Show, and they gave him his own 10 p.m. variety show at a time when Jay Leno was doing really, really well in The Tonight Show. And I think that NBC really regretted promising Conan The Tonight Show and creating this sort of like line of succession like years in advance. By the time that the plan finally got enacted, Jay was actually still king of late night, and they didn't really want to make that move, but they had to make that move. So they moved Jay into the 10 o'clock slot, and Jay failed in the 10 o'clock slot. He wasn't pulling in the ratings that they needed in prime time. And meanwhile, Conan was kind of struggling against the late show with David Letterman. So they made this risky, unpopular move that backfired in their faces. They removed Conan. They put Jay back into the Tonight Show. And now today, a year later, Jay's actually pulling in fewer people than The Late Show with David Letterman, and he's not doing as well as Conan did at this time last year. Jon Stewart over on Comedy Central is doing better than all of them, at least he did in the month of October. So, yeah, that move didn't really work out for NBC.
So the whole late-night landscape seems to be changing. What about David Letterman? Is he just sitting around watching this go on and enjoying it, or does he have some problems as well?
I think he's pretty amused by all of this moving around. He really wanted the Tonight Show job when it originally went to Jay Leno many years ago, and he was really disappointed by all that. He went to CBS, and he's had his ups and he's had his downs. Right now he's kind of, you know, up, and I think he's pretty amused by everything.
You know, what do people think about the future of the sort of traditional late-night TV format? Is there a future for that sort of traditional sitting back on the couch talking to TV stars format?
Yeah, I do. I think it's such a staple part of television, and it's cheap, you know. The networks make a lot of money off of the late-night shows. I think that there's going to be a long future for this kind of thing, as long as it continues to generate this kind of revenue for networks.
Okay, one other thing. Got to ask you about Conan's beard. He started growing one when he left The Tonight Show. Any reports on whether we'll see it or not?
I think this is the burning issue for Conan O'Brien fans. Like, you know, wither the beard. I want to know if there's a betting line on whether or not he's going to shave it on air, either on his first show on Monday or sometime during the week. You know, maybe he can, like, you know, shave it in stages, you know, like there can be like a little bit every day, and by the end of the first week he'll be clean shaven. He has said he's going to keep the beard, but, you know, I'm riveted by the beard. I want to know.
Okay. Jeff Jensen of Entertainment Weekly, thanks so much for being with us, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. 12 enchanted brothers, 12 boys who became swans, receive magic cloaks that return them to human form. Except for the youngest brother. His cloak was missing a sleeve, so he's stuck with one human arm and one arm that's a swan's wing. You might recognize that story, The Wild Swans, a tale by Hans Christian Andersen. In a present-day retelling by Michael Cunningham, this brother develops a dark, dry sense of humor about the unfairness and randomness of life. He's a solitary fellow, but also an entertaining drinking buddy. Michael Cunningham, Joyce Carol Oates, and dozens of other writers revamp old fairy tales for a new collection called My Mother, She Killed Me, My Father, He Ate Me. One of those contributors is playwright and screenwriter Neil LaBute, and he joins us from our studio in New York. Welcome to the program, Neil.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is Kate Bernheimer. She's the editor of this collection. She joins us from member station KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona. Good to have you also, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
So why were you interested in putting together this collection of contemporary fairy tales, which really give a contemporary spin to very old stories?
As a writer, I've been for such a long time dedicated to this incredibly artistic tradition. I began to notice that fairy tales were perhaps the greatest influence on a lot of contemporary writing, but hardly ever mentioned in reviews or criticism of those works, except perhaps as an aside. I felt that it was high time to restore fairy tales to their literary place as probably the broadest influence on writing over the ages.
Did you pick writers based on a feeling that they had been influenced by fairy tales or that they had some kind of connection with the fairy tale tradition?
Absolutely. I mean, as a reader, coming to my reading as a writer immersed in fairy tales, I can't help but notice in so many stories, plays, poems that I read, the sort of breadcrumbs of fairy tale techniques. So I'm very excited when I notice that in some Unusual Suspects. Neil Labute is a great example of that. I've always felt that his work had a very intimate relationship to the tradition of fairy tales. And I selected writers basically just with the goal to having a diverse range.
Neil Labute, have you thought of your writing as being influenced by fairy tales?
Oh, of course. I mean, my life was, so I would think my writing would be. As a child, you take in what you're given, and I think a lot of your morality is created not just from, you know, going off to church, but going back to those stories that you hear over and over. I think a lot of these stories, there's great pleasure in going back and trying to find the originals, that a lot of these have been filtered for our own good, apparently, and made to be happier than they might have originally been.
Now, your story is based on the Rumpelstiltskin story. Maybe you could remind us of that story quickly first, for those who may not have read fairy tales as children.
Well, there's a great exchange given there. There's a someone who's going to weave gold out of straw, and the king tries to get out of paying Rumpelstiltskin for his work, and he exacts a price and takes a child, and only his name is the way in which Rumpelstiltskin can be foiled.
Yeah, what did you want to explore with that particular story in your own writing?
Well, for me, I think that the thing that's always fragile in stories are, you know, what they connect on such a simple level, and because when you're a child, you're often hearing these things for the first time, is that they prey on the notion of children and a child at risk here. It's as simple as that. So the idea that I could take that story and bring it absolutely up to the moment, a story of a child who's in danger, and prey on that as a writer, as it preyed on me as a reader.
I wonder if you could read from the story, just the very beginning of it. It has a very threatening feel, and I wanted to hear you read that.
Happily so. I'm back. I am back, and you knew I would be. You knew it, didn't you? Yes, you did. You give me that look. You knew exactly what was going to. It doesn't matter. I'm here now, so we should get started, get this thing all started and going. Go ahead. You can throw up. It's not going to stop me, make me feel bad, I promise you. It's not. You're getting exactly what you deserve here. You are. You deserve it, and that is what's going to happen.
And, of course, what you're playing on here, you're talking to a mother, and you are her worst nightmare because you are threatening her with her worst fear, the loss of her child.
Well, and protectively for Rumpelstiltskin himself, I think that she was this character's worst nightmare.
And you feel a lot of sympathy for Rumpelstiltskin.
I do feel a certain sympathy. I guess I don't know if it's, you know, a desire to always throw in for the underdog or, a problem with authority. It's probably a little bit of both. I try to see, as a writer, you don't want to judge and you want to see as many points of view as possible.
You know, Kate, I was fascinated by the many different directions that writers went in with their stories. Neil stuck very close to the idea of the Rumpelstiltskin story, whereas other writers seem to leave the story way behind. Francine Prose, for instance, in her story based on Hansel and Gretel. It took me a while to sort of see, well, what's the connection between this story and Hansel and Gretel?
I really wanted to represent in this collection the stylistic variety among writers of fairy tales, because I think that that diversity really is remarkable in literature, that these sort of false divides of realism and non-realism, fairy tales themselves reject that binary. And Francine Prose's story is a good example of that. The story sort of feels like narrative realism, but when you get to the end, you feel that you've been transported.
Part of me was just sort of surprised by which characters writers chose to focus on. Like, for instance, Neil, you focused on Rumpelstiltskin, not on the woman that he helped. One of the writers said that she was really more interested in creating her own innovative fiction. Is that how you thought about it, Neil?
Not for me, no. I in the same way, you know, when I direct say, somebody else's play or screenplay. I try to keep my fingerprints off it in a certain way. I mean, there's going to be – it's filtered through my sensibilities. It's going to have my take on it, my rhythms even. But I'm trying to get something of the original. I want people to be able to call back to that and you know, relive it, re-enjoy the pleasures they had the first time they heard that story or they've thought about it since.
You know, it's fun because the way you can go through this book, you can either go through looking for your favorite writers or you can go looking for your favorite fairy tales, which is sort of what I did. I know I'm a big Hans Christian Andersen fan, and so I went through right away looking for the stories that I really loved as a kid to see what somebody had done with them.
I arranged the book specifically with that exact kind of treasure hunt in mind, that a reader could look at the annotated table of contents and fasten upon a place of origin, a contemporary author, a beloved or reviled story from childhood, any particular tradition, or even just a line from their tale, because one line or a passage from each story appears in that contents. I wanted people to sort of go through the book just as they wish, sort of make their way through that woods and find some beloved space in there that could comfort or help them.
Kate Bernheimer is the editor of My Mother, She Killed Me, My Father, He Ate Me. It's a collection of 40 new fairy tales, and she joined us from member station KUAZ in Tucson. Playwright and screenwriter Neil Labute contributed to the collection. He joined us from our studios in New York. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.